Chapter 13. The Manner and Method of Entering This Night of Sense. Some counsels are in order now that the individual may both know the way of entering this night and be able to do so. It should be understood, consequently, that a man ordinarily enters this night of sense in two ways, active and passive. The active manner of entry, which will be the subject of the following counsels, comprises what a man can do and does by himself to enter this night. In the passive way, an individual does nothing, for God accomplishes the work in him, while he acts as the recipient. This will be the subject of the fourth book, where we shall discuss beginners. Since with God's help, I will there give counsels pertinent to the numerous imperfections beginners ordinarily possess on this road, I shall not take the time to offer many here, nor is this the proper place to give them, since presently we are dealing only with the reasons for calling this journey a night, and with the nature and divisions of this night. Nevertheless, if we do not offer some immediate remedy or counsel, this part would seem very short and less helpful. Therefore, I want to sit down the following abridged method, and I will do the same at the end of my discussion of each of the next two parts, or reasons for the use of the term night, which with God's help will follow. Though these counsels for the conquering of appetites are brief and few in number, I believe they are as profitable and efficacious as they are concise. He who sincerely wants to practice them will need no other, since all the others are included in these. First, we have a habitual desire to imitate Christ in all your deeds by bringing your life into conformity with His. You must then study His life in order to know how to imitate Him and behave in all events as He would. Second, in order to be successful in this imitation, renounce and remain empty of any sensory satisfaction that is not purely for the honor and the glory of God. Do this out of love for Jesus Christ. In his life, he had no other gratification, nor desired any other than the fulfillment of his Father's will, which he called his meat and food. For example, if you are offered the satisfaction of hearing things that have no relation to the service and the glory of God, do not desire this pleasure or the hearing of these things. When you have an opportunity for the gratification of looking upon objects that will not help you come any closer to God, do not desire this gratification or sight. And if speaking, there is a similar opportunity, act in the same way, and so on with all the senses, in so far as you can duly avoid this pleasure. If you cannot escape the experience of this satisfaction, it will be sufficient to have no desire for it. By this method, you should endeavor then to leave the senses as though in darkness, mortified and empty of pleasure. With such vigilance, you will gain a great deal in a short time. Many blessings flow from the harmony and the tranquility of the four natural passions: joy, hope, fear, and sorrow. The following maxims contain a complete remedy for mortifying and purifying the passions. if put into practice these maxims, will give rise to abundant merit and growth in the virtues. Endeavor to be inclined always, not to the easiest, but to the most difficult, not to the most delightful, but to the harshest, not to the most gratifying, but to the less pleasant, not to what means rest for you, but to hard work, not to the consoling, but to the unconsoling, not to the most, but to the least, not to the highest and most precious, but to the lowest and the most despised, not to wanting something, but to wanting nothing. Do not go about looking for the best of temporal things, but for the worst, and desire to enter for Christ into complete nudity, emptiness, and poverty in everything in the world. You should embrace these practices earnestly and try to overcome the repugnance of your will toward them. If you sincerely put them into practice with order and discretion, you will discover in them great delight and consolation. These counsels, if truly carried out, are sufficient for entry into the night of senses. But that we give abundant enough counsel, here is another exercise which teaches the mortification of the concupiscence of the flesh, the concupiscence of the eyes, and the pride of life, which St. John says, reign in the world, and give rise to all the other appetites. First, try to act with contempt for yourself, and desire for all others to do likewise. Second, endeavor to speak in contempt for yourself, and desire all others to do so. Third, try to think lowly and contemptuously of yourself, and desire for all others to do the same. As a conclusion to these counsels and rules, it would be appropriate to repeat the verses presented in the Ascent of Mount Carmel, which are instructions for climbing to the summit, the high state of union. Although in the drawing we admittedly refer to the spiritual an interior aspect, we also deal with the spirit of imperfection existent in the sensory and exterior part of the soul, as is evident by the two roads, one on each side of the path which leads to perfection. Consequently, these verses will here bear reference to the sensory part. Afterwards, in the second division of this night, they may be interpreted in relationship to the spiritual part. The verses are as follows. To reach satisfaction in all desire, its possession in nothing. To come to possess all, desire the possession of nothing. To arrive at being all, desire to be nothing. To come to the knowledge of all, desire the knowledge of nothing. To come to the pleasure you have not, you must go by a way in which you enjoy not. To come to the knowledge that you have not, you must go by a way in which you know not. To come to the possession that you have not, you must go by a way in which you possess not. To come to be what you are not, you must go by a way in which you are not. When you turn towards something, you cease to cast yourself upon the all. For to go from all to the all, you must deny yourself of all in all. And when you come to the possession of the all, you must possess it without wanting anything. Because if you desire to have something in all, your treasure in God is not purely your all. In this nakedness, the spirit finds its quietude and rest. For in coveting nothing, nothing raises it up, and nothing weighs it down, because it is in the center of its humility. When it covets something, in this very desire it is wearied. Chapter 14. An explanation of verse 2 of the first stanza. Fired with love's urgent longings. Now that we have explained the night of sense to which the first verse of this stanza refers, and have discussed the nature of this night, the reason for calling it night, and the method of actively entering it, we should logically continue with an explanation of the admirable properties and the effects contained in the remaining stanzas. I shall explain these verses, as promised in the prologue, by merely touching upon them, and then proceed to Book 2, a treatise on the remaining or spiritual part of the night. The soul then states that fired with love's urgent longings, it passed through this dark night of sense to union with the beloved. A love of pleasure and attachment to it usually fires the will toward the enjoyment of things that give pleasure. A more intense enkindling of another, better love, love of one's heavenly bridegroom, is necessary for the vanquishing of the appetites and the denial of this pleasure. By finding his satisfaction and strength in this love, a man will have the courage and the constancy to deny readily all other appetites. The love of one's spouse is not the only requisite for conquering the strength of the sensitive appetites. An enkindling with longings of love is also necessary. For the sensory appetites are moved and attracted toward sensory objects with such cravings that if the spiritual part of the soul is not fired with other more urgent longings for spiritual things, the soul will be able neither to overcome the yoke of nature nor enter the night of sense, nor will it have the courage to live in the darkness of all things by denying its appetites for them. This is not the appropriate section for a description, nor would it be possible, of the nature of these longings of love, or of the numerous ways they occur at the outset of the journey to union. Neither is it the place for a discussion of the diligence and ingenuity of persons in departing from their house, self-will, into the night of the mortification of their senses, nor of how easy, sweet and delightful these longings for their spouse make all the trials and dangers of this night seem. It is better to experience all of this and meditate upon it than to write of it. We shall proceed consequently to the next chapter and explain the remaining verses. Chapter 15. An exposition of the remaining verses of the first stanza. Ah, the sheer grace! I went out unseen, my house being now all stilled. The soul uses as a metaphor the wretched state of captivity. It is a sheer grace to be released from this prison without hindrance from the jailers. The soul, through original sin, is a captive in the mortal body, subject to passions and natural appetites. When liberated from this bondage and submission, it considers its escape, which is unnoticed, unimpeded, and unapprehended by its passions and appetites, a sheer grace. To achieve this liberation, it was advantageous for the soul to depart in the dark night, that is, in the privation of all satisfactions and in the mortification of all appetites, as we mentioned. My house being now all stilled means that the house of all the appetites, the sensitive parts of the soul, are now stilled, and the desires conquered and lulled to sleep, until slumber comes to the appetites through the mortification of sensuality, and until this very sensuality is stilled in such a way that the appetites do not war against the spirit, the soul will not walk out to genuine freedom, to the enjoyment of union with its beloved. End of the first book. Book 2, Chapter 1, the second stanza. In darkness and secure, and by the secret ladder disguised, ah, the sheer grace. In darkness and concealment, my house being now all stilled. This second stanza tells in song of the sheer grace that was the soul's in divesting the spirit of all its imperfections and appetites for spiritual possessions. This grace is far greater here because of the greater lordship involved in quieting the house of man's spiritual nature and entering this interior darkness. The spiritual nudity of all sensory and immaterial things, leaning on pure faith alone, in an ascent by it to God. The secret ladder represents faith, because all the rungs or articles of faith are secret to and hidden from both the senses and the intellect. Accordingly, the soul lived in darkness, without the light of the senses and intellect, and went out beyond every natural and rational boundary to climb the divine ladder of faith that leads up to and penetrates the deep things of God. The soul declares it was disguised, because in the ascent through faith, its garments, apparel, and capacities were changed from natural to divine. Because of this disguise, neither the devil, nor temporal, nor rational things recognized or detained it. None of these can do harm to the man who walks in faith. The soul's advance, moreover, was so concealed, hidden, and withdrawn from all the wiles of the devil that it indeed involved darkness and concealment. That is, the soul was hidden from the devil, to whom the light of faith is worse than darkness. We can say, as a result, that a man who walks in faith is concealed and hidden from the devil. This will be more evident as we proceed. The soul consequently affirms that it departed in darkness and secure. For anyone fortunate enough to possess the ability to journey in the obscurity of faith as a blind man with his guide and depart from all natural phantasms and intellectual reasonings walks securely. The soul also asserts that it departed in the spiritual night because its house was now all stilled. That is, the spiritual and rational part of the soul was stilled because once the soul attains union with God,
the natural faculties and the impulses and anxieties of the spiritual part remain at rest. The poem does not proclaim that the soul went out with urgent longings, as it does of the first night of sense. To enter the night of sense and denude itself of sensible things, the soul needed the longing of sensitive love. But all that is required for a complete pacification of the spiritual house is the negation through pure faith of all the spiritual faculties and gratifications and appetites. This achieved, the soul will be joined with the beloved in a union of simplicity and purity, and love and likeness. It is noteworthy that, in considering the senses, the poem asserts that the soul departed on a dark night, and in speaking of the spirit, it says that the soul went out in darkness. The obscurity of the spirit is far more intense, just as in darkness indicates thicker obscurity than dark night. For, however dark a night may be, some objects are still visible, but in total darkness nothing at all can be seen. In the night of sense there is yet some light, because the intellect and reason remain and suffer no blindness. But this spiritual night of faith removes everything, both in the intellect and in the senses. As a result, the soul declares in this stanza that it departed in darkness and secure, which it did not affirm in the former. For the less a soul works with its own abilities, the more securely it proceeds, because its progress in faith is greater. This will be the subject matter of Book 2, and we shall discuss it at length. The devout reader consequently must proceed thoughtfully, because our exposition will be most important for persons of genuine spirituality. Though these truths are somewhat obscure, they so shed light on one another that I believe they will all be clearly understood.